You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Barbara Ehrenreich was educated as a scientist, but gave it up to be a journalist, a best-selling author, and a crusader for social justice. Her latest book, Living with a Wild God, is a memoir that revolves around a notebook she kept as an adolescent. It was the beginning of her inquiry into the nature of life, her search for deeper truth, and a description of an experience so profound and disturbing that it might have been described as religious if she weren't an atheist. The book is published by 12 Books, and I'm very pleased to welcome Barbara Ehrenreich back to our show. Hello.
Good to be back with you, Leonard.
How did you come to rediscover the notebook?
Well, I guess I had always known that it was somewhere because it managed to survive many, many moves to different houses, states, apartments, whatever. And then
had you opened it up every so often?
No, never looked. I sort of knew what was in there, but very generally. And then in 2001, I had the simultaneous experience of being treated for breast cancer, and unrelated to that, having a librarian come from a university library to, quote, collect my papers. And so we had spread out all these boxes and papers, and I saw the envelope that I knew contained the journal, and I snatched it up. She couldn't have that. The library could not have that. And so I guess the combination of, well, I might die a little sooner than I thought due to the cancer or something, and finding the journal then made me think, I've got to return to this.
Well, you said that you weren't afraid of dying, but you felt awful that the girl who wrote the notebook would die with you. Do you think of her as your ideal self, the person?
Oh, I don't think she was ideal.
Well, she was the person who kind of was what later led to you.
Right, but I can't connect all those dots, really. I think life is full of just surprises. Well, you're not expecting sometimes.
Were you surprised to find that the format you often use in it was a direct appeal to your older self?
Well, it's addressed to my older self. So, for example, there's an entry quote that I give in the book from when I'm 16. And I imagine myself a few months later reading this entry. And I'm kind of begging my future self to be a little bit compassionate about what she reads. Actually, it was decades before I read that. And the real challenge of that little entry, though, is it's addressed to the older me, and it says, what have you learned since you wrote this?
Well, how ambitious was the scope of this notebook? It wasn't your typical high school diary. There's nothing about best friends and hoping that the captain of the football team would invite you to the prom.
No, I was an extreme nerd. You know, I had friends, mostly misfits, by the end of my high school career. But the only thing I thought that was worth writing about in this journal was what I was learning on my quest to understand everything.
And that was your goal? That was the goal of the journal?
That was the goal of my life.
Understand everything?
Yeah. Don't you laugh? No, and I framed that when I was probably 12.
Well, looking back on your career and the success of a number of your books like Nickel and Dimed and Bait and Switch, do you feel that you are still on that quest? Because those are more limited in their scope, although they're very important to understanding our society.
Like another part of my life. There are various channels at work here, as there are in most people's minds. You know, one part of it has to do with reporting. It's very topical, journalistic. Other parts more scholarly. And then there's all these philosophical questions.
But there's also the sense that you wanted to change the world.
Not when I was 12. I just wanted to understand it.
You were raised as an atheist, and you say that was a family tradition?
That was a family tradition going back in one line of the family, several generations. And this is kind of interesting because I think we often think of atheists as people who are educated, you know, skeptical-minded, cosmopolitan, whatever. These were poor people, working class people. Most of the men were miners or railroad workers in the family.
Do you know where the tradition, I guess we can call it tradition, began? There are a lot of people who are who don't practice, who don't think about religion, who might be hard-pressed to tell you whether they're an atheist or an agnostic or a lapsed something. But we're talking about people who were atheists.
Yes, and there is a particular story that my father always told and attributed this to, that his great-grandmother had been a Catholic, an Irish. They were mostly Irish, and sent for the priest in this little town or even mining camp somewhere in western Montana in about the 1880s. She sent for the priest when her father lay dying. The priest sent back a note saying he would come for $25, which was an unbelievable sum. So that was the end.
Or even charging at all to do this sort of thing that a clergy person is
right,
expected
to
do.
That was it. It was for Mamie O'Loughlin, this ancestor of mine. Because a few years later, she herself lay dying, young, in childbirth. And the priest showed up. Somebody else must have alerted him to her death. And he attempted to perform the last rites. And he must have put a crucifix on her chest. But the story is that with her last ounce of strength, she hurled that crucifix across the room. Now, that's not a very agnostic statement.
No.
And that's sort of the origin story as far as our atheism went.
Was science the alternative? Because science is a way, of course, of understanding the world. It's the way it was developed to understand the world.
Yeah, well, for me, yes, I was such a rationalist. I was also, I will admit, very much interested in literature. You know, and I was just reading all the great books all the time because we didn't have young adult books in those days. Had to read the good stuff. But my father was sort of a lapsed scientist, and it was left to me to take it from there.
Did this make you a bit of, you said you were nerdy, did it make you a bit of an outcast as a child? Because most of your friends must have been believers of some sort.
Well, at times.
I mean, people were reciting the Lord's Prayer in many parts, and they still do.
Well, we had to. Not only did we have the Lord's Prayer in school, and I would move my lips, as much so as not to be noticed. But we had half a day a week on Wednesdays, which were dedicated to, quote, religious instruction. And all the other kids in the class were bussed off to their places of worship for some religious lessons. And one person remained, and that was me. I couldn't go home. I had to sit in the classroom with whatever teacher was kind of minding me. And then it was perfectly obvious there was something unusual.
Was this while your family was still in Butte, Montana?
No, we moved a lot. We moved all over the place.
Well, you say that Butte isn't really cowboy country and that Buttans see themselves as atypical Montanans. Did your family think of itself that way?
Well, Butte was a copper mining city. Until I guess that all really fell apart in the 1960s. But it was a very cosmopolitan city in some ways. It had people from, men came from all over Europe and even Asia and even the Middle East somewhat to work in the mines of Butte. It was the first place in Butte that had a synagogue. Go to the old cemetery in Butte. It is amazing that there are, Chinese tombstones. There are ones in Arabic.
And people said they lived in Butte, USA, rather than
Butte,
Montana.
We wanted to skip to Montana. Because Montana makes people think of horses and cowboys and things, and that's not...
And the big sky.
Well, we had the big sky, of course.
Did some people think it's gorgeous, others think it's oppressive? But it does make you think about the cosmos when you... look up there at the stars.
Well, yes. I can't say that's where it all started with me, but you are very much aware of sky. Now, with solution to that, in the days when Butte was a very active mining city, was the pollution from the smelting of the copper. So it was usually a hazy sky, unless we sort of drove out of Butte itself.
My guess is Barbara Ehrenreich, who has followed up her bestsellers about the economy and living in the current economy with something quite different, a memoir called Living with a Wild God, A Non-Believer's Search for the Truth About Everything. It is published by 12, a publisher that only publishes 12 books a year, one each month. An important factor here is becoming aware of death, because it just became a theme. Your mother committed suicide. Your father may have tried to commit suicide.
I don't think he did, but...
Well, he had a car crash.
So. Yeah, well, he had a lot of car crashes, but that's what happens when you drive drunk.
Uh-huh.
But it struck me as a child, without any of these losses in my family, that there's something strange going on here. You know, we live for a short time, and then snuff, you know, it's over. What's all that about?
Isn't that why religion is comforting for so many people?
I'm not interested in comfort. I'm interested in truth.
Well,
yeah, no, I mean, you could talk yourself into saying, well, yeah, there's a heaven waiting for me, and that may be very comforting. I can't.
Well, religion is also a means of creating a community, along with a comfort in the face of death. Did you find substitutes?
And yes, I think I have plenty of community in my life, but it mainly through the various social justice causes and movements I've been involved in.
So you also say that you had a rule as a child to think in complete sentences.
Mm-hmm.
You weren't one of those kids who today would have been saying like.
Well, I probably would not be clued in on the slang, whatever it was. But no, it was in many ways a rough childhood, as are most people's, I think. And that was just a little trick I learned, was don't just sort of whine in your mind or sob in your mind or physically. Try to think and organize your thoughts into sentences.
But is that why you left out of the journal a very intense kind of experience that you were beginning to have repeatedly?
I left it out until finally I had to confront it even in the journal. And that's because I didn't have words for it.
You describe it as dissociative.
That is the word I came across only in recent years in trying to understand these things, dissociation.
Well, it's to a novice, these experiences sound like the sorts of things people are hoping to experience when they meditate.
I don't know. I've never I've tried meditation for maybe 5 seconds at a time, but no. When it started up when I was 13, and it was not an emotional experience at first in any way. It was just that the world changed. It was like a layer peeled off, and I saw the underlying reality without any words attached or human associations, or just what it is.
Could you get more specific? Sounds like some kind of a mystical experience.
Yeah.
The sort of thing people associate with religion.
Right, but I'm not religious, so I had no way of putting it that way. No, I don't know either. You know, many religions... certain religions at different times in their history firmly squelch people who have anomalous kinds of experiences. They want the monopoly on your access to any alternative reality.
Well, it depends on whether you lead the soldiers of France to victory or whether you experience defeat.
Well, yes. I mean, it's a mixed history. Actually, that's something. It's not what my book is about, but I've always been fascinated in is the Catholic Church's struggles sometimes using, sometimes trying to squelch mystical experiences on the part of Catholic people.
Did you talk about these, I'm going to call them mystical experiences, with anyone?
No.
Why?
No.
Were you embarrassed by them?
Well, I thought I would be judged crazy, insane. And what I had to read at the time, you know, the library books, suggested that it was mentally ill not to see the same reality, so-called, as everybody else.
It was an experience you had repeatedly. Do you know what precipitated it?
No. I tried to understand that. I couldn't make it happen. It would happen or not. But it had, strangely enough, it had something to do with light and the sky. These things did not happen in the winter or when it was raining.
Also happened in the when you were in the desert.
Well, that was the...
Because a lot of people had mystical experiences throughout history in the desert.
What is it about deserts?
Well, I guess it's the vastness.
Yeah.
I mean, it's even more big sky than Montana.
Yes. Well, it was actually started in the mountains, in the Sierra Nevadas. And long story short, I was there on a rather poorly planned trip. And
to go skiing?
Yeah, with a friend and my brother. We ended up not driving back to L.A. after skiing. We lived in L.A. We ended up instead sleeping in the car in Lone Pine, California.
I've been to Lone Pine. That's where there was a Japanese detention camp during World War II.
Oh, no.
You have Mount, what is it, Mount Whitney on one side and Death Valley on the other side.
Death Valley is south.
Yeah.
Yeah. I didn't know that.
Yeah, you also have the Alabama Hills, which is where they shot most of the westerns during the 30s and 40s.
Darn, I'm going to have to go back there now. I have never been back. But, yeah, I just stepped out of the car totally exhausted, hungry, not much sense of where I was, and was walking in the streets of this, at that time, very little town. And there was what I later learned could be called a mystical experience. You know, when
what happened?
The words that I can find, the image, is that the world, the whole world, flamed into life. It was like blazing. The experience was...
Did it look like things were on fire?
Yeah, yeah. Burning bush, sort of. Mm-hmm. I mean, and that's, you know, again, it took many years before I made the connection to...
And you weren't taking mescaline or anything.
Oh, no. I wasn't that kind of kid, no.
In fact, we have a photograph of you on our show page at around 18, and you have this very innocent gaze.
It's a little bit of a smart-ass gaze, too,
if you
look carefully. Yeah. But no, I don't know what psychedelic drugs do to one's mind. But this was not just a distortion of reality. It had the feeling of an encounter with a living something.
And that often makes people think about religion again and whether they're... there is some reason to believe, because these are things that are hard to explain just through science.
Sure. Yeah, no, I would say, though, that what I experienced and seemed to see had none of the normal attributes of God, as we know God in our monotheistic culture. It wasn't good. It wasn't loving. It was completely out of those categories.
Well, then there were other religions that can be explained, religions that have practiced shamanism, for example.
Oh, yes. There are so many varieties of religion. In fact, I have more respect for those religions that do not require belief, but that offer rituals, ecstatic rituals usually, that allow you to actually make contact with the deity or spirit.
You began to indulge in a fantasy that you were the last living person on Earth. Looking back, were you being a bit solipsistic?
I was very solipsistic. In an intermittent way, it was, you know, obviously I lived with people, and but I had, in a strictly rationalist way, say that I had no solid evidence that other people were actually autonomous conscious beings like myself.
Do you think this is because you were a lonely child, just living within your head?
I think it was also that I was so determinedly rationalistic.
So this was a kind of a relief from that?
No. Why should I take the leap? And it is a little bit of a leap to see every person that I encounter as another conscious being.
They're saying things that you can't predict?
If they surprise me, I'm a little more likely to be. No, but I mean, not to be a little silly about it, but you could be an android, very cleverly designed.
I think I'm more likely to be an Apple phone, but that's a whole other thing.
Oh, well.
Anyway, you also had an experience I mentioned in the desert. You were exhausted from physical exertion, emotional stress, lack of sleep. And that can be an explanation for this sort of thing.
Oh, yes.
People who went on long fasts sometimes had mystical experiences. In the end, are you still having these kinds of experiences?
Nothing on that scale. I almost said, thank God. That was very shattering, what happened to me when I was 17.
Do you think any of these things are connected with the way your life proceeded as an activist?
To me, it seemed like becoming an activist was a turn away from this line of inquiry, a point where I really did decide to throw in my lot with my species, I fell in love with people, my children, my friends, my comrades in the movement, and everything seemed to change.
But also, your family, to some degree, has moved in that direction. You may not have been close to your mother at a certain point, but she got involved in the civil rights movement.
Mm-hmm.
Became involved with opposition to the Vietnam War. You were going to Reed College, where I guess pretty much everybody was opposed to the war.
I wasn't that interested. I wasn't. Again, there's a change here, and I maybe, you know, this is not an autobiography. I do not connect. I do not really take responsibility for making a solid narrative. I'm just telling you as it happens. And for me, it was when the draft started threatening my fellow students. And I just was appalled.
Well, an awful lot of religious people were also opposed to the war. Before you go, the title, Living with a Wild God. Since you don't believe in a God, can there be a wild God? Why a wild God or any God?
One of the things that has impressed me in my studies in the recent decades is the varieties of religions. If you were to go back before monotheism, say 2,500 years ago roughly, or even, you know, much closer to our own time, different cultures.
There are cultures right now that are polytheistic.
Well, polytheistic, but also animistic. And more commonly in, you know, at the edge of history, the deity was an animal, or an animal-shaped person. A person who sort of looks like an animal or has some of the qualities of an animal. So it's just, I think the word God can be used very, very loosely to mean an other than human.
And you think, so the visions were kind of like about being other than human?
I think one of the big mistakes of monotheism is the idea that we are made in the image of some deity who also created the world. That's a terrible mistake.
That's the subject of another conversation. Barbara Ehrenreich is the author of 14 books, including the bestsellers Nickel and Dimed and Bait and Switch. Her latest of a real departure is called Living with a Wild God, A Nonbeliever's Search for the Truth About Everything. It is published by 12. And I thank you so much for being on our show again.
Well, thank you, Leonard.